Again, on the subject of behavioral trends, investors are generally reluctant to buy stocks which are high priced in absolute terms. The stocks that trade at 4 or 5 figure prices like MRF, iShares to name a few. When you look at the performance of high priced stocks, many of them tend to do well relative to the market. Of course, there's an opportunity here for other investors when a large section of the market overlooks something. You're both a practitioner and a teacher of behavioral finance. So what explains this bias?
It's basic nature. You know, we are we tend to think in absolute numbers. You know, a stock price that is a 1,000 rupee stock price looks more expensive than a 10 rupee stock price or a 20 or 30 rupee stock price. And if it's a 2 or 3 rupee stock, it looks like really cheap. But cheapness or expensiveness should be seen with reference to something, reference to value. So it's a classic anchoring bias. You know, you start thinking about a number and you start thinking, oh my God, this is like so expensive. It's gone up. It's like 2,000 rupees share. And you ask me, how do you overcome this? And I think it's a very simple way to do it, do this, really speaking. You know, just think in terms of aggregate values. Like MRF is worth about like 28,000 crores and iShares is worth about 56,000 crores today. So you just take the number of shares and multiply by the shares outstanding and look at the aggregate market value of the company, and you have a number. And then you compare that number with fundamental factors like total earnings or cash flows or future cash flows or earnings or book values or dividend paying capacity, so many things. And don't think in terms of per share when you're doing valuation. I mean, there are situations when you should think about per share. To be sure, for example, when you think about dilution, you know, new shares coming into the market and reducing the stake of the existing shareholders, whether that was done on terms that are favorable or not favorable and so on. But when it comes to valuation, you should think in terms of whole business, not how many slices are there in that business pizza, so to speak.
When the price of a stock is falling, most investors like to average their purchase cost by buying more shares. But when a stock price is rising, most investors generally do not want to average up their cost. What could be the reason for this?
So I do this in class. I ask my students that would it be possible, what are the circumstances in which a stock at 200 is a safer and more lucrative asset to own than when it was at, let's say, 100 bucks a couple of years ago? And if you force yourself to think about it and ask yourself what are the conditions under which a stock at 200 is better buy than at 100 bucks, it forces you to think about those circumstances. So what could those be? Let's just try to think about that. When it was 100 bucks, it was an unproven business model. It was a newer company. It had very little track record. At 200 bucks, some years have gone by and there is a proven track record. It has gone from a small company to a medium-sized company. It has gone from a levered balance sheet to an unlevered balance sheet. Some of the competitors may have dropped out and you may have gotten a higher market share or dominance in the market. You may have got some pricing power. So yeah, to be sure, the stocks doubled, but the value may have trebled. So the margin of safety is actually expanded. So if put in those terms, it is then a better buy at 200 than it was at 100. Moreover, when you bought it at 100, because it was a riskier asset, you would put only a small position on the name in your portfolio. You don't want to put like 15% or 10%, you're putting like 2%. But at 200, the business is proven and you've got more conviction and you also have learned more about it. The moat has emerged and the management has executed and the balance sheet is better and the returns on capital have become better and the scalability is now apparent to you. And then you're thinking about that in terms of value, and the value is coming out to 400 or 500. So you would now be having much more conviction and you might put a 7% position or a 10% position in that stock. So I think the idea of not buying more of a business that is executing brilliantly just because the stock price has gone up a bit is not a good idea.
A lot of value investors tend to avoid companies that raise capital frequently. Understandably, investors don't like their equity to be diluted or interest cost eroding profitability. But then companies also need capital if they have to grow. What are your thoughts on this?
So that depends on the business model. My personal preference is towards businesses that can fund all growth without... I mean, I don't like businesses that don't grow. I want businesses to grow. But I also want the ability to grow without the need for outside capital markets, debt or equity. Which means that the internal cash flow generation is sufficient to fund all growth or the business is not that capital intensive. Now, this condition obviously doesn't apply in all situations. It certainly doesn't apply to financial companies for whom money is raw material and they have to keep borrowing money from the markets to lend it forward. But when it comes to having more equity capital in the balance sheet and raising money from outside equity investors, you have to be very careful about how to analyze that situation. You have to, one way to think about it is that I'm not going to do this. I don't like companies which dilute equity, and that's a perfectly legitimate way of thinking about it. But an alternate view could be that, okay, here is a company that needs to go to outside capital market. What are the terms on which they do that? So some companies are very good at this, and you know, when the stocks are selling at high valuations, they will go and raise more money. And then when stocks selling at low valuation, then they won't. So all you have to focus is the management aligned with the minority shareholders of the company.
It is said that it's easier to analyze companies and decide what to buy than it is to decide when to sell. Are there any basic rules one should keep in mind when it comes to booking profits?
You tell me. I'm still learning this.
You just mentioned the fear of missing out a short while back. Do you think that plays a bigger role in holding back investors from cashing out?
Huge role. And we're all guilty of this to some extent because, you know, you see a bull run and you are participating in that and you see the value of your shares go up a lot. And then you start thinking, to borrow this famous line from a Hindi song, Abhi to party shuru hui hai. And you don't want to lose out on future profits that will surely occur if you sell them. And you may have had some experiences in the past that you sold something and went up and up and up. And everybody has had that experience. And it's painful and nobody wants that. So you stay invested regardless. So it is a difficult decision, no doubt about it. And there are specific psychological reasons why selling is so much harder than buying. When you sell something, you're selling something that you've owned for a few years. So there is this attachment, there's an emotional attachment to it. It may have gone up a lot, and therefore you think it'll go up even more and you don't want to sell. Or it may have gone down and you're saying, my God, if I sell, I'll have a loss. And you're anchoring to the cost that you paid, or there's a emotional aspect that you believe that you're a great stock picker, but you know, if you sell it, you'll have a loss and you don't like that loss, emotional pain. So that prevents you from selling.
Behavioral science has become quite popular among investors. How has it helped you take better investment decisions?
Well, many years ago, I came across this talk by Charlie Munger on the psychology of human misjudgment. And it's been, it was a game changer for me. Because the first time I found that there is a discipline of behavioral economics, which you could study from and learn from. And in that particular talk, Charlie laid out some 20 standard causes of human misjudgment. And he's given a second version of that talk, which is even better than the first one. And of course, he was drawing a lot upon his own experience of learning psychology from books like Influence by Robert Cialdini, for example. I think, as I mentioned earlier, that there are three big ingredients to being a successful investor. You need to understand accounting, you need to understand business, and you need to understand psychology. Those are three subjects that you need. And if you don't understand psychology, including your own psychology, and the biases that you have, if you don't overcome them, then you are trading against people who may not have those biases, and therefore you are kind of the patsy in the game. So if you want to avoid losses, you need to have that knowledge. You need to understand psychology. It's been extremely, extremely useful to me.
You're a voracious reader, and your reading list is closely tracked by many in the investing community. Tell us something about your reading habits. What do you enjoy reading? How much time do you set aside for reading every day? Also, are there any books that has influenced you deeply, both as a person and as an investor?
As to the last one, I think we should have a separate podcast for that.
Yeah, sure.
There's a whole subject. I've read a lot of books, and there are books on different disciplines which have influenced me and I think might help some of your listeners to pick up those books and learn from. As to your other questions, I just love reading. You know, that's one thing which I was always fond of since a kid. I used to just love reading. You know, being alone with a book is more pleasurable than being in a party. And some people are like that and some are not. So I was of a type that, you know, you're sort of an introverted person and you just want to be alone and with a book. And, you know, whatever it is, it could be Hardy Boys when I was a kid. It could be Agatha Christie or whatever. So I just love reading. And today my reading choices are guided by a lot of book friends that I have friendship that I've developed over the years. You know, I have a few people who I've never met, but who interact with me only on books, because they found and I know that the books that they recommend are different. And so in a sense, I do get influenced by the choices of some of these people who will send me a recommendation or send me a book over the years that I picked up. And it's a reciprocative kind of a relationship. I'll tell them what are the books that I like. So today I like to read books on other disciplines because I think the discipline that I teach and I practice is multidisciplinary, and it draws from models from disciplines other than finance, and therefore it makes sense to read in other disciplines. I end up reading maybe 4 or 5 books in a month, but I would like to read more. My library is bigger than the books that I've actually read, and I think that's again been a net plus to me in many ways. One, it forces me to pick up a book because I have pressure to read it before buying another one. But the other big benefit of having a large library, at least on my Kindle, is that when I'm doing research on a specific topic, I could search across all books for a specific concept. So it's interesting because the books that I bought have been bought after careful research. You know, either I know that this author is great or somebody has told me, and I may not have read the book, but now I'm doing research. So it's already a carefully curated selection of books on my Kindle. And now I am looking for a subject. I'm doing a blog, or I'm doing a research on some specific topic, or I'm developing a lecture. I search for a specific term across all books, including the books that I have not read but I own. And that almost always leads me to discover things that I didn't know, which are very relevant to that particular subject. So in that sense, I think that alone is a good enough reason to have a large, in my case, Kindle library, or there are other e-readers out there, where you have all these books which have been collected over the years and which you will read over a period of time. But even if you have not read them, they are research resources for you.
So do you discuss investments with your children? Are you keen that they know about the basics of investing early on?
I don't discuss investing, but I discuss psychology a lot. Because, you know, when I studied, got interested in psychology, my kids were very small and I was using them as kind of, you know, guinea pigs. Mm. You know, my little daughter, she was, I think, 6 or 7 years at that time. She knows concepts like social proof and contrast effect, and a lot of concepts that I talk about in classroom. I don't talk numbers and finance, and professional work is different when I am with my kids, because psychology is fun. There are all these lovely experiments which you can do on children, you know, marshmallow experiment and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's fun. It's been, for me, it's not been talking about investing or money, but it's a lot about psychology. So the books that I've talked about, the concepts that I've talked about with the kids have almost always revolved around psychology, not investing.
On that note, Professor Bakshi, thank you for taking time out for us and sharing your thoughts, experiences and learnings with our listeners. I'm sure they would have found it very interesting.
Thank you, Santosh. Thank you for having me again. It's a pleasure to be with you.
This has been a Money Control presentation.